It's pretty bad. Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 15th of May, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, and myself, Brian Gerrish.
Where are we starting?
Well, we better start, I think.
With a health warning.
With a health warning. Theresa May, of course, described by a qualified person as suffering from a cult mentality.
Yes, indeed. So she was meeting with somebody else that may well have a cult mentality. That's Jens Stoltenberg from NATO, of course. She was meeting him yesterday in Downing Street, apparently about wide-ranging discussions on security issues. She congratulated him on the extension of his appointment as Secretary General of NATO to 2022 and on what she described as a successful start to NATO's 70th anniversary year. They discussed the upcoming NATO Leaders Summit, which is going to take place in London in December. And they agreed that the summit would be an opportunity to celebrate NATO's strengths and look ahead to the next 70 years of the alliance. So that makes you feel very good, I presume.
Haven't we left? I think we've left the alliance of...
Not NATO.
Oh, no, sorry, not NATO.
Yes. Well,
Freudian slip there, actually, after a busy weekend.
Well, no, it's a good point, because it's increasingly difficult to tell the difference between NATO and the EU these days anyway. But anyway, let's have a look at them. As she walks out of number 10 Downing Street to shake hands with Stoltenberg. They then went on to talk about some of the security challenges, Russian aggression, China, Iran. And he, of course, is very concerned that the US and EU have different opinions on what to do about Iran. But the key thing is that Iran must not end up with nuclear weapons. And they also were noting NATO's important role in combating terrorism, especially in Iraq and Afghanistan. So that's all good stuff. Well, we can't leave it there, because NATO was also heading over to the EU Foreign Affairs Council, which also took place yesterday. And this is the Deputy Secretary General, Ms. Rose Gottemuller. And she was attending the Foreign Affairs Council yesterday, which, contrary to the title, was actually all about defence, because in the EU, of course, foreign affairs and defence are the same thing. And so they were talking mainly about hybrid threats. But if we move on to just the EU Foreign Affairs Council itself, the main sort of topic of conversation was Africa. So just before we get into that, I want to remind everybody of this.
First of all, our collective defence, we are ironclad committed to NATO. NATO of 29, that is collective defence Article 5. But there are problems and issues where I do not see NATO, but Europe has to be able to act.
Though this transatlantic alliance with America is extremely important and we need to maintain it, the best partnership is a partnership where we have our own capabilities that are also strong.
I was talking about Africa. This is not a typical place for NATO. We are very committed to NATO in other places, but Africa is a place where we need to be able to act as Europeans.
For example, one of the things that my institute does is work in Africa, and at the moment we're particularly focused on the Sahel group of countries. That's that band of countries across the north part of sub-Saharan Africa, where you've got exploding populations, dire poverty, radicalization, and extremism. We may well face the next wave of migration and extremism from those countries. It makes perfect sense for Europe to have the military capability to help those countries with their security.
And for that, we created the European Defence Union, to have a comprehensive approach with diplomacy, economic development, and the military means.
So that's just a quick reminder that Ursula von der Leyen there, the German defence, the current serving German defence minister, and Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister, absolutely on the same page with respect to EU Defence Union, and absolutely on the same page with respect to the fact that, well, NATO has a role in the world, but doesn't have a role in Africa, it seems. So the Foreign Affairs Council meeting yesterday was all about the Sahel region. It's a priority for the EU, apparently, because there have been intra-community conflicts, terrorism, 5,000 people killed in the last 5 months, and so on. So this is what it was all about. So foreign and defence ministers discussing the situation in the Sahel with their counterparts from the G5 Sahel countries. That's Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania and Niger. The meeting was an opportunity to reaffirm the strategic importance of the Sahel for the EU, which stands by the G5 Sahel countries in their effort to address multiple challenges. They discussed how to address the deterioration in the security situation and the increased presence of terrorist groups and so on. So the Sahel, absolutely a key target for the EU, not just the Sahel, because also the countries to the northern part of the Sahara Desert as well. So this is the EU neighbourhood map, which the EU has produced kindly for us here. And you can see that right across North Africa and also the Eastern Mediterranean countries, including Israel and Syria and Lebanon and so on, key targets for EU expansion, and also to the east with Ukraine, amongst others. So Georgia as well on that list. So this was apparently a very positive, deep and frank discussion, and they highlighted the need, the support that they can give for Sahel countries to ensure the provision of basic services and so on. Just to remind everybody exactly what countries we're talking about, it's this region just on the southern edge of the Sahara Desert. So they're very keen that this becomes or falls under the influence of the EU. Currently, it seems to be more influenced by China, who are helping to develop those countries at the moment. The EU not really interested in development, much more interested in making sure that the sort of insurgency process continues.
It's quite incredible, Mike, when you look at that map and you can look at Europe, which has absolutely been decimated by the EU project. Absolute mayhem within Europe and getting worse. And yet in the minds of the European leaders, they're going to move into Africa in order to improve life of African people. And what do we need to do to improve their life? Well, we need to bring in military and security capability.
Yeah.
This is quite frightening stuff, because we're getting deeper and deeper into the way that these people think, and it's clearly not nice.
It gets better, because also on the list for discussion, of course, was PESCO. PESCO, one of the many EU military unification acronyms. So they were discussing, defence ministers were discussing PESCO after its first full year of implementation. They reviewed the progress made, the implementation of 34 projects agreed within that particular framework. And of course, this is about the unification of EU defences. And they were taking stock of the ongoing discussion and general conditions under which third states could be invited to participate. Well, of course, which third state are they particularly interested in having participate?
Well, I could mention Ukraine as one, but...
No, well, the key one is Britain, of course.
Oh, Britain, okay.
Yes. So they reaffirmed their commitments to complete this work as swiftly as possible. The European Council has also adopted a recommendation assessing the progress made by participating member states to fulfil commitments undertaken under this framework. Also at this meeting was a meeting, or a European Defence Agency ministerial. So here they are all sitting there quite happy. Well, what were they talking about? They were talking about pursuing its work in key research and capability development domains. Does that make sense?
Yes, because this is going to take over everything.
Right. So they were talking about AI, artificial intelligence. They want to define it. They want to create a taxonomy and a glossary document, apparently. And then they're going to launch an innovation prize for the area of artificial intelligence. And then in a second step later this year, they're going to do some in-depth analysis of concrete AI defense applications in areas where capability gaps exist. They also asked, the steering board also asked the agency to pursue the implementation of the 2018 EU capability development priorities. Now, just to remind everybody, this is the EU's own diagram for how they envision European Defence Union. The eight pillars in the centre there, of course, they say quite clearly that European Defence Union cannot stand unless all those pillars are in place. So we've got NATO on the right-hand side there. We've got bilateral agreements, including the ones that Britain and France, Britain and Germany, Britain and Netherlands, Britain and Italy, Britain and Poland and so on are involved in. There's PESCO there, the second pillar. And the third pillar is CARD. And CARD is the Combined Annual Review. This is where we have annual defence reviews across the EU. Britain has taken part in these as well. Although Britain calls the annual ones mini reviews, we've got some larger reviews which happen, I think, every 5 years. But the key point about CARD is that it makes sure that those reviews are coordinated, because what they want to do at the end of the day is to achieve a minimum overlap or minimum duplication of effort. They want to make sure that each country that's providing its military into the Defence Union is not providing the same capabilities that other countries have, so that money is being spent appropriately. So that is one of the key pillars. That was one of the things which the European Defence Agency ministerial was discussing yesterday. And the other thing they were discussing was military mobility. Now, of course, this is all about creating highways and mechanisms for military personnel and materiel to get from one part of Europe to another, east to west, and also north to south. So 22 member states were taking place in this one. That was Austria, Belgium, Bulgaria, Croatia, Cyprus, Czech Republic, Estonia, France, Greece, Hungary, Italy, Latvia, Lithuania, Luxembourg, Malta, Netherlands, Poland, Portugal, Romania, Slovakia, Spain and Sweden. And they signed a new programme that will facilitate the granting of cross-border surface and air movement permissions. It's developed in the framework of the European Defence Agency's work on military mobility, and it implements an important part of the action plan on military mobility. So that's another done deal, it seems. We'll no problem moving people southwards if maybe we have to move men and material towards Africa.
Quite incredible the speed that this is building up. And of course, we've still got silence in press and media in UK, and utter silence on EU Defence Union. We're going to mention AV10 in a minute, and David Ellis's talk on EU Defence Union was really impressive in getting the detail across. But remember, while this massive European military build-up continues, the British public and others in the world are being told that all of the blame, of course, stems from Russia itself. And I'd just like, with a little bit of black humour, to bring in this email that we received today. A little bit small to read that on screen, so we'll give you some help here. But I was shocked, because clearly, Mike, this had come from Putin himself. It was Russian cyber. It was a scam. But we thought we'd give you some mainstream media evidence. So let's have a look at what it said. Hello. We're a direct provider of bank instrument BGMT760/MTN/SBLC, specifically for lease. And also, I'm looking for a reliable person who will receive contract over invoice payment cash of US 10.5 million with a storage house to be shared as follows. You're entitled to 30%. I thought it was looking good at this stage. For securing the fund as a subcontractor, 70% for me and my colleagues. Your urgent response is highly needed. And of course, the evidence that this was the Russians is here, because that's would appear to me a Russian address. So
that must be true.
This is the kind of very dangerous cyber attack. But luckily, we've got several billions of pounds going into organised such as GCHQ, and they are protecting us from this dangerous cyber attack.
So if they're protecting us from this dangerous cyber attack, why did you receive it?
Can't answer that.
Right.
No, I can't answer that.
Oh dear.
But we just remind people, of course, the reality is that as far as the European Union is concerned, those EU sanctions continue. This is just one of many pieces of rhetoric on the European Union's own web pages. EU sanctions against Russia over the Ukraine crisis, and those all stand because of the actions of the Russians.
Yeah. Okay, well, here we have, one image at least from Alternative View 10 over the weekend. And this event just gets better every year, Brian. More and more people. The place was absolutely chock-a-block. And the you know, if we go back a few years ago, it used to be laid out slightly differently with tables that everybody sat around. There is no room for tables anymore. So the hotel, absolutely full.
Absolutely full. What are we talking? We're talking close to 400 people. And what was remarkable about this, new people, okay, there's a body of people who come on a regular basis, many, many new people. I sat down to watch one of the other speakers, got talking to the very nice couple next to me. They'd come all the way from Seattle in the United States to be at that event. And when I spoke to them a little bit later on and I said, how are you finding it? They said, we just cannot believe the amount of information being brought across, and we cannot believe how friendly people are. It's really lovely to be here. And that was really echoed by so many people, that they just found the atmosphere was wonderful. And it demonstrates really how people are getting hungry for accurate information about what's going on. And when you bring people together in a delightful setting as that hotel is, it was just wonderful to see people behaving normally. Serious subjects, Mike, of course, some of them very, very dark and heavy to sit through. But then you were hearing people discussing, but we also heard laughter. So that was good. Well, one of the speakers at AV10 was this lady, French lawyer, Georgia Pouliquen, and she has been speaking out about what the French state has been doing with regard to the yellow vests. We've had the pleasure of, UK Column has had the pleasure of interviewing her. That interview will be made available very shortly. But Georgia, immensely brave, because obviously English is a newly learnt language for her, but she got up on the stage and talked about her experience, her knowledge about what the French state is doing to the yellow vests. And she put up some really, really powerful film clips showing the brutality of the French police against perfectly peaceful demonstrators. In fact, some of those images were very difficult for some people in the audience to see. But her testimony was so powerful that towards the end, some people were crying. And shortly after she came off stage, she experienced people hugging her as a means of thanking her for coming all the way from France to try and get the truth out about what's happening in America.
In France.
I beg your pardon, in France. Now, there are some little clips on YouTube, which we will be helping people to go to and see. We'll be talking you through what's happening with this. But I'm just about to show you just one of the images that was put up on screen at AV10. If you have weak disposition or you don't like physical injuries, I suggest you turn away from the screen. But this is the reality of what Macron's government is doing to the French people. This is just one facial injury, which is caused by the deliberate targeting of French yellow vest protesters by baton rounds. And it is obvious that the police have been targeting their heads. They have red dot laser sights on these weapons. So wherever that dot goes, the baton round goes. And horrific injuries. This man hit, obviously, in the mouth. But many, many people have lost eyes. And then many people have also lost hands as a result of the grenades that have been used. So Georgia Pouliquen has come all the way to England to explain to us what is really happening in France. And of course, we have almost nothing within the British mainstream media in the press about these terrible attacks. This is another image that came up on screen at AV10. And this really made a big impact on the audience because, of course, this image showing Macron as a sort of version of Hitler was originally published by Le Monde. So this was a mainstream news outlet in France. But what happened very quickly was immense pressure from the French government forced. Le Monde is forced to apologise after likening President Emmanuel Macron to Adolf Hitler. But when the British public see the horrific injuries which have been posed on the yellow vest demonstrators. And remember, those demonstrators, not just in cities where they say that the police have been involved in agitation and deliberate provoking of violence, but the demonstrations across wider France have been inevitably totally peaceful. So something very, very unpleasant coming to the surface now about what the French state is doing.
Now, of course, if the mainstream media isn't covering what's going on in France with the yellow vests, the question is, will social media still be available in the not too distant future? Because, well, Theresa May is in Paris today to meet other world leaders for a summit. And the summit is called Christchurch Call. So this is an online extremism summit. It's prompted by the Christchurch mosque attacks from New Zealand, which killed 51 people. And of course, that event was live streamed to Facebook. So this summit is going to focus international efforts to stop social media being used to organise and promote terrorism, as they describe it, with attendees expected to sign up to a joint pledge called the Christchurch Call to Action, which is going to eliminate terrorist and extremist content online. So Theresa May said is saying that the sickening attacks on Muslim worshippers in Christchurch shocked the world, that 1.5 million copies of the video had to be removed by Facebook and could still be found on YouTube for as long as 8 hours after it was posted. It's a stark reminder that we need to do more, both to remove this content and stop it going online in the first place. And of course, while we absolutely agree that somebody running around anywhere with a gun and shooting at people should not be on social media, at the same time, this, of course, is not going to be limited to that type of content, as we've explained on this program, for example, following the publication of the Online Harms White Paper. So this is what Theresa May had to say. My message to governments and internet companies in Paris will be that we must work together to harness our combined technical abilities to stop any sharing of hateful content of this kind. But as I say, if we look at the timeline on this and look at the discussion that began really with David Cameron in 2014 at the United Nations General Assembly, while they are talking about terrorist content, they are not limiting this to terrorist content by any means. And of course, while they're talking about right-wing extremist terrorist content, for example, the Christchurch event, they're not really talking about, for example, White Helmets content or some of the content pushed out by friends of the White Helmets from Syria, because that material stays up quite regularly. So anyway, they want the internet apparently to be a safe place for all our citizens, and that's why they've announced plans for new legislation in the UK creating a legal duty of care on internet companies to keep users safe from harm, and this will be backed up by an independent regulator with the power to enforce its decisions, is what she's going to say this afternoon. Britain is the first country, she's going to say, to put forward such a comprehensive approach, but it isn't enough for us to act alone. The internet is global, and online threats have no borders. Companies should be held to consistent international standards so their customers enjoy the same levels of protection wherever they are. So just, sorry.
Well, I was going to say, you mentioned an independent regulator there, Mike, to help us stay safe. Presumably that would be a government-appointed independent regulator.
Yes. And paid for, of course, as well. Yes,
good.
Yes, good. But it doesn't end there, because in one of these sort of amazing coincidences, Brian, today the Home Office has published new analysis which has revealed that a white nationalist and neo-Nazi discussion forum, which is not being named for operational reasons, has seen more than 12 million posts in response to almost 1 million individual discussion threads, and has amassed more than 800,000 visits in just 1 month, with 10% appearing to originate from the UK. So this UK government analysis has also highlighted, apparently, how a variety of different platforms and a wide range of anti-establishment themes are being used to lure in a broader audience and expose them to far-right material, further underlining the need for enhanced cooperation to keep pace with emerging threats and deal with extremist content before it reaches illegal terrorist thresholds. But absolute coincidence that that report was released today.
I think very significant it came out today. It was a shame that Theresa May wasn't available to attend AV10 because I think she would have learned quite a lot. She could have mixed with some very good people who live not only within UK, but we had people from Romania, we had France, we had Germany, we had Switzerland, we had Denmark, and all the people who'd come in from those other European countries or the European countries, all saying they were desperately concerned at how they were seeing the same controls coming in their own governments. But Theresa May apparently too busy to get to AV10. Maybe we could invite her for next year.
I think we
should. That would be productive. Well, mentioning the lady again, I think we should just bring in this one. Thank you very much to the person who sent this through, a report from Free Nations. And I found this very interesting because, of course, a little while ago, the BBC, I think, was trying to put the knife into Theresa May by making a fool of her with regard to her negotiations. Now, whatever we think about Theresa May, I think this little episode has backlashed. So the headline here from Free Nations was "Imperialist EU shows its hatred of Britain. BBC sinks its own Euro-fascist project. UK flourishes." And the article is really pointing out that the BBC very devious in supporting movement into what was then the common market. But of course, the BBC knew full well it was to be the European project, the super state with its own EU defence union, its own super state military. What did the BBC documentary show? Foul language and really appalling behaviour by the European project leaders who would like to control this country. Worth having a look. Free Nations. Well, let's come over to The Guardian. And thank you again to another viewer who pointed this out. It's Catherine Viner. She's tweeting out that The Guardian has made a small operating profit. It's been a brilliant team effort. And it's mostly thanks to Guardian readers. We are out of danger and the new business model is working. Now, this lady is the head editor. We've been hearing quite a story about The Guardian because we've heard that as money has got tight, it's clearly that they weren't making any money at all. Very oppressive management system, journalists losing their job. And many people were talking about a poisonous atmosphere inside The Guardian. Now, I know you've got a slightly different take on this one, Mike.
It's not really a different take. Basically, The Guardian has £1 billion in a slush fund, which was provided to them by the Scott Trust. Now, the Scott Trust is no longer underwriting The Guardian as they once did, but they did leave them with £1 billion in the bank. But up until this most recent set of results, The Guardian was losing about £50 million a year. So Catherine Viner's point a year or so ago was that The Guardian can't continue to lose £50 million a year. It's got to be making a profit. So she's saying that it has made a profit this year. But how did they get from making a £50 million a year loss to making a small profit? Either it was some accounting shenanigans, or if the information you have is correct, which I have no reason to doubt, then it's because the culture has changed somewhat within the organisation, and perhaps they've refocused their efforts in particular directions, which maybe has changed the culture to a point that some people don't like it quite so much anymore.
Yeah, well, let's just have a little look at this. This is very interesting because, of course, the Guardian is so powerful. So here we are. Here's Catherine Viner, Editor-in-Chief, Guardian News and Media. And this is her Twitter page. And I just found it fascinating to see what she was talking about. Here she is. She says, "In these disorientating times, championing the public interest, which has always been at the heart of The Guardian's mission, has become an urgent necessity." I wrote a long article about this. So she's recognising that public are getting totally disorientated because they can't see any proper news. But don't worry, we, The Guardian, are doing it.
Well, I would disagree with that. They may once have thought of themselves as championing the public interest, for example, when they were quite happy to make a profit from or to make money from WikiLeaks in the past. They don't seem to want to do that anymore. In fact, they've gone quite the 180 degrees away from that. So I think most people watching this program would agree that what Julian Assange and WikiLeaks have been doing was in the public interest. So I'm not entirely clear that they are still championing the public interest.
No. Well, I'm certainly not clear, Mike, because I did a little bit of research this morning through the Twitter pages of The Guardian and also across their news feeds. And what came up on World News was this hot headline, Sex, Dragons and Dirty Tricks, Video Games for Game of Thrones Fans. From royal role-playing to battle simulators, these games will satisfy Westeros refugees as the TV saga nears its end. Now, this came under World News. Is this where they're making their money now? Because really, The Guardian is now a video games industry. Well, make your own mind up, but I did what I always do, which is to go to look at what journalists produce this. Here's the journalist, Keza MacDonald. We can see the big inset article there. But I was intrigued to see this here. So under Keyser's details, it talks about Dark Souls out now. And this, of course, is advertising because Keyser's been one of the joint writers of this particular commentary. What are we talking about? We're talking about this. I've just taken a little bit of the text. Dark Souls is a fascinating anomaly in the world of video games, so challenging and so intriguingly opaque that even years after it was released, we're still puzzling out its secrets. It's made an indelible impact on everyone who's played it. Every single person who's finished Dark Souls has been through the same, quote, harrowing, exhilarating journey, triumphed over the same near impossible odds, and even seen the words, you died, flash up on screen approximately 10,000 times. It's a game that creates stories, little mini narratives of unlikely triumph and fearful discovery. And my comment on this, Mike, is what is the effect on the minds of adolescents if you tell them 10,000 times that they've died? Is this a good thing to be doing to our children and young people? And of course, what The Guardian doesn't seem to want to get near is what are the risks to the mental health of adolescents and children who have perhaps got some underlying mental health issues when they play this sort of game. But not to worry, because The Guardian is protecting public interest by feeding us this material. I believe it comes under the UK column category of dross. But I think there's some serious risks here. We'll come back to the journalists because people might like to go and have a look for themselves. And I also found this one, which I found very interesting. So it's a retweeted article. It didn't originate from Keza themselves, but terrific article on how, quote, broken Brexit Britain is influencing video gaming. So we're now at the point that we're making games. How are young people to know what is reality and what is not? And why isn't The Guardian focusing on who broke Britain? So a few questions for our viewers and listeners there. But I think it's time that people started to tackle these journalists over why they're producing this sort of material. And are they being responsible in doing so? We don't think so. But to come back to the matter in hand, Mike, here's the answer to the questions. We are the most read quality news brand in Britain with 25.2 million readers getting, quote, their news fix from The Guardian. Mm-hmm. So The Guardian is using drug language to what I'm happy to say is dross, but I think it's more than that because this is a very dangerous attack on people's minds. And perhaps we could end this segment by saying that, of course, the one thing The Guardian will not talk about is EU Defence Union. And by that omission, we've got pure deceit that the British public are not being told the truth about what's really happening with our constitution and common law. These are vital issues, but The Guardian prefers to make a bit of money on video games.
Well, good news, Brian. Good news. Good. Because Vodafone is launching 5G on the 3rd of July this year. This is spectacular news. As the company has made a number of announcements, according to this article on 5G.co.uk, So it's going to launch 5G in Birmingham, Bristol, Cardiff, Glasgow, Manchester, Liverpool and London on the 3rd of July. And then later in the year in Birkenhead, Blackpool, Bournemouth, Guildford, Newbury, Portsmouth, Plymouth, Reading, Southampton, Stoke-on-Trent, Warrington and Wolverhampton. So this is the first UK network to give a date for when it's switching on its 5G services. And it doesn't, but it doesn't necessarily mean it will be the first network to launch 5G, according to 5G.co.uk, because EE is likely to make an announcement straight away. But Vodafone apparently is the first to offer a 5G roaming service for people that are coming to the UK. So this is fantastic news. And why am I saying that? Because I think the message that came from AV10 at the weekend absolutely clearly is that this issue is causing people to join together, no matter what they agree about or disagree about in other policy areas. The issue of 5G is bringing people together in a way that we haven't seen on any other issues. And I think there's going to be a real fight on their hands to get this industry established in the, get this variant of the industry established in the country, because many people asking where the precautionary principle is with respect to 5G. We have the precautionary principle shoved down our throats by government and local government in a whole host of policy areas, not least with respect to health and well-being and lifestyle. And yet, with respect to this area of lifestyle choice, the precautionary principle doesn't seem to apply. So there are many, many questions to be answered here, and a huge amount of interest amongst people on this issue. So as it begins to be rolled out, I think this is going to galvanise and waken people up very, very quickly.
Indeed, Mike, it was really astonishing to see the reaction to the subject of 5G. We've talked about many emotive subjects, but it's clear that the cutting down of trees is something which just instantly people latch onto. So people at the venue were reporting their own experiences within their areas of UK and indeed overseas about trees being cut down. And then, of course, as speakers were giving detail about why this is in order to facilitate the 5G networks. A very harsh response from people. They want to stop it. Somebody's just come into our chat room and said actually they were able to hand out 1,000 5G leaflets. Obviously, people at the conference were taking bundles of them, but this shows the passion because people wanted to get out on the streets and start to do things. So 5G, if you're not aware of it and you're not aware of the immense health risks and the fact that trees are already being cut down in the hundreds of thousands to facilitate this, please do some research, UK Column website or elsewhere on the internet. Now, some people have accused us of always giving a pro-Russian line, which I don't think is correct, but we thought we'd just highlight this article that was sent through to us today, that Moscow is to weave AI face recognition into its urban surveillance net. There's quite a lot of detail in this article about the firms involved, but a little bit here is more than 160,000 cameras already watch the capital's 12 million people on the streets and its sprawling subway system. And now Russia's artificial intelligence development companies will vie for the chance to have their programs run the show. And I think they're almost doing a little bit of a competition there, Mike, to see which of the AI developers can produce the most accurate model. So this is Moscow. I believe that this report is correct. And if so, this is very dangerous for the Russian people. So we would encourage everybody who's concerned about this type of surveillance to get stuck in. And then to switch things, good news from San Francisco. I'll say grudgingly reported by the BBC, San Francisco is the first US city to ban facial recognition. And we're told in the article that, of course, we desperately need facial recognition to keep us safe. I don't know how we've managed to keep safe for thousands of years without it, but now we can only be safe while we're buying our weekly groceries if somebody can actually recognize us by our facial features. Great to see some comment coming in for some interesting people. So this is a gentleman called Matt Cagle from the American Civil Liberties Union in Northern California. He said this: with this vote, San Francisco has declared that face surveillance technology is incompatible with a healthy democracy, and that residents deserve a voice in decisions about high-tech surveillance. We applaud the city for listening to the community and leading the way forward with this crucial legislation. Other cities should take note and set up similar safeguards to protect people's safety and civil rights. And I really don't think we could end with a better message, because this is utterly key, isn't it, Mike, that people are not just following what the UK column is saying or even what we're suggesting. It's vital that people out there in their own communities take stock of what's happening around them, decide what action they're going to take, and then get out there and do it for themselves. But it's quite clear that something needs to happen, because these draconian state technologies are now accelerating daily. Mm. And if we allow them to come fully into place, we are not going to be able to speak out. There will be no free speech. And of course, with that comes very, very dark and dangerous dictatorships. Well, let's just say thank you again to everybody who attended AV10. I was overwhelmed by the comments and the support that I had from many people. UK Column did receive a number of very kind donations from individuals, so thank you to that. Mm. And I'd also, I sit here slightly in a daze. It's been a very, very busy 4 days. It was just wonderful to see so many people from so many different countries talking, interacting, laughing, joking, and supporting each other. And, you know, Mike, they were able to do that without a set of guidelines from the European Union on hate speech.
My goodness.
My goodness. We'll leave you there. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back at the same time on Friday. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.